Welcome to Sunshine Studios, home of the Steve Piasecki podcast. Dead Stripper is the first book in the Steve Piasecki series. But a word of caution before you continue. Dead Stripper contains explicit content, such as strong language and the depiction of graphic sex and violence, including murder. Therefore, this podcast might not be suitable for all audiences. Forewarned is forearmed. And now, into Chapter 18 of Dead Stripper, when we go to Steve's apartment and find out whether or not he succeeded with the editor in New York City. Then, Jess joins him for a little roll in the sack. But once again, comes a pounding on his door, and Steve is in for a whole heap of trouble. Scene 63. The next morning at Jefferson Court Apartments. Despite my awkward introduction to the editor-in-chief of Excalibur magazine, Rose Goldenberg, the New York trip ended well. Who knew she ran the magazine out of her apartment and didn't open for business until 10 o'clock? Not me. So I pled my case. She read the first two pages of my story and liked the way it opened. She agreed to give my story a fair shake. Now I have to back up my words. So I go online to check the editorial requirements for Excalibur. There are four. Number one, material never published before. Check. Number two, no multiple submissions. Check. Number three, word limit 5,000 words. Check. Number four, must include two graphic sex scenes. Can't check this one. And it says those sex scenes must be at least 500 words each. The sex scenes must flow organically within the plot and fit seamlessly with the overall plot. Like I said, I can't check that editorial requirement. Not yet. And since my story is already 5,000 words, the first thing I have to do is go back and delete 1,000 words of existing plot. And that's not easy, because it's tough to trash words that you slaved over to get to come out just the way you wanted them. Then I got to create two graphic sex scenes of 500 words each to replace the 1,000 words I'm trashing. And finally, I got to weave the new scenes invisibly into the story and make it shine. Well, that sounds like a lot of work, and it is. Don't get me wrong. But believe it or not, the two graphic sex scenes will be easy to create thanks to an old girlfriend. Let's call her Carol. She was always full of surprises, and she instigated at least a dozen graphic sex scenes during our time together. I only need two. Here's one. We're driving across the Walt Whitman Bridge one night on our way home from the shore. Traffic's heavy and cars are all around us. They take my full focus. "What do you think, baby?" she says out of the blue. I glance to the right and see that she's balls-ass naked. Then she unzips my jeans, climbs on top of me, and we're fucking. I mean, she's bouncing up and down and screaming like a banshee. I'm looking over one shoulder, then the other, and trying to avoid smashing into any cars. It was scary as hell, but a whole lot of fun. The scene needs some embellishment, plus a couple trigger words to add some sexual zing, but it's a good start. The second scene comes after dinner one night in Old City. We leave the restaurant and walk a couple blocks to the car. It's parallel parked on Front Street between Walnut and Chestnut, and almost bumper to bumper. It takes four or five backups and pull forwards to work my way out of the spot, which takes my full attention. And once again, I miss her stripping down naked. Then she unzips me, gets on her knees on the passenger seat, and starts blowing me as we pull away, which plants her bare ass against the passenger window and gives pedestrians and passing cars an interesting sideshow. Again, the scene needs some embellishment and a few trigger words, but these two scenes will come across realistic as hell because they really happened. I'm ready to get started, but someone's knocking on the door. I go over, check the door. It's Jess, and her timing is perfect. With these two graphic sexual memories still flowing inside my brain, I lead her straight into the bedroom and start taking care of business. Scene 64, an hour later. "Want to do it again?" Jess asked me. "Again?" Jess rolls toward me, leans over, and kisses my cheek. Well, you must think I'm some sort of sex machine. You do have some skills in that department. I mean, you definitely know your way around, shall we say, this and that. Police, open up! Police, open up! Not again, she says. What the fuck? I bolt out of bed naked. Be right there. I put on my jeans and sneakers. No time for socks. What should I do? Get dressed. Oh, and call my lawyer. His card's on the bureau. Next comes my black shirt from yesterday, and I'm buttoning it while I walk down the hall. Scene 65. I open the door and see the same two detectives standing outside. Between them, I see a uniformed police officer and two men in coveralls. What the fuck? Search warrant, the female detective says. The male detective sticks the warrant in my face. You have the right to remain silent, but anything you say can and will be used against you in a court of law. You have the right to an attorney. If you cannot afford one at this time, one will be appointed to you by the court. With these rights in mind, are you willing to talk with us? Just one word. What's that? Go fuck yourself. That's three words. No shit, Sherlock. The police officer spins me around and handcuffs me. He leads me out of my apartment, down two flights of stairs, and outside to a police car parked at the curb. Scene 66. At the same time, Detective Bishop opens the top drawer of one of the file cabinets and starts leafing through the file folders. Meanwhile, Detective Gerber's looking at the books in the bookcase. This guy's obsessed with crime, he says. That's all he reads about. Writes about it, too. She pulls a small box out of the bottom drawer of the file cabinet. This is computer software for writers. Big deal, the way I see it. The more he reads, the more he learns. And the more he learns, the more he gets curious about getting away with murder. Just like Leopold Loeb. Who? Two college kids, rich Jew boys from Chicago back in the 1920s. They had genius IQs, and they thought they could commit a perfect murder and get away with it. There was a movie and a book written about them. The book and the movie both called Compulsion. Ding, ding, ding. Detective Gerber pulls Compulsion out of my bookcase. Here it is. No shit. To me, he says, it looks like this guy thinks he's a genius, decided to act one out. You really think he killed her? Who else? One of the men in coveralls comes walking up. What do you want us to take? Let's see. Detective Bishop looks around the room. Laptop, printer, all the books, and wheel out the file cabinets. Scene 67. 5 minutes later, at the Clifton Heights Police Department, right up the street on Springfield Road. The arresting officer leads me through a small cell block. It's brighter than I imagined. There are only two cells and both are empty. He stops suddenly and I stop. He removes a handcuff from my left wrist. Put your left hand on the wall, up high. I reach up and place my left hand on the wall. He removes the handcuff from my right wrist. Place your right hand on the wall, up high. I reach up and place my right hand on the wall. He pats me down, then spins me around. You can put your hands down now. He points to the right. We're going through that door. A few steps later, we're inside a large lobby. Stop at the counter up there. I step up to the counter, stop, and see a sheet of bulletproof glass separating me from a middle-aged woman on the other side. Do you have any identification, sir? She asks me. It's in my front pocket. I nod downward. May I? Yes, sir, you may. I reach into my pocket, pull out some folded money. Mixed in between the money, I find my driver's license. An aluminum basket slides out from underneath the counter. Please place your ID inside the basket, sir. I place my license inside the basket, then watch the basket slide back underneath the counter and disappear. She picks up my license and looks at it. Stephen Piasecki? Yep. She confirms my address, weight, height, and social security number while simultaneously key punching the information into a computer. Then she sends the basket back out. Take your driver's license, Mr. Piasecki. Thank you. I pick it up, stick it back in between my money, put everything back inside my pocket. Mr. Piasecki, you are being charged with possession of a controlled substance, possession of said controlled substance with intent to distribute, and the sale of said controlled substance. Do you understand these charges against you? Ma'am, if I may be so bold, I have no clue why I'm being charged with anything. I understand. Would you like to contact a lawyer? That's already in progress. Mr. Piasecki, are you now or have you ever been a member of any gang or drug cartel? You're kidding, right? No, sir, I am quite serious. Do I look like a member of a gang or a drug cartel? In my opinion, Mr. Piasecki, you do not. But looks are sometimes deceiving. Not in my case. I understand. Please remove your personal belongings and deposit them inside the receptacle. The officer is now holding a plastic container. It looks like one you might use to store clothing or dirty laundry. Like what? Your keys, watch, rings, jewelry, wallet, cell phone, oh, and your belt. I have $32 in cash, my license, a debit card, and a cell phone. I deposit everything inside the container. Mr. Piasecki, you may keep your socks on. I didn't have time to put socks on. In that case, you may keep your shoes on if you remove the laces. I'm not planning on hanging myself. I am sure you are not, but you must do it anyway. I bend down and remove my shoelaces. Then I stand up and place the laces inside the plastic container. Thank you. Is that everything? Yep. The officer takes over. No keys? Left them in my apartment. Watch? Don't own one. Wallet? Don't own one. Belt? Never wear one. The officer slides a container with my belongings across the counter, and the middle-aged woman starts tagging my belongings inside the container. This way, scene 68. The officer leads me back the way we came in, all the way to the spot in the cell block where he patted me down before. Stop. I stop. Just a warning for your own good. From this point on, if I find any weapons or contraband on your person, you'll be charged with a felony. Do you understand? I don't have either. Strip down. Uh-oh. I never saw this coming. It takes me a minute to strip down, adjust my shoes, and no two ways about it. This is the most embarrassing moment in my life. This will go a lot easier if you put your hands against the wall, just like last time. I assume the position with my back facing him and both hands high up on the wall. And I remain standing like that for a few seconds. Turn around. I turn around. His eyes scan me up and down. Put your clothes back on. Thank God, no cavity search. I dress fast. Now what? Take your pick. He points at the two empty cells. I pick the cell on the right, step inside, and hear the cell door slam shut behind me. Then I turn around to face the officer. How long am I going to be here? Not long. Your paperwork should be ready soon, and then I'll be back for you. And he walks away. I'm suddenly all alone inside a jail cell, under arrest for a crime or crimes I never committed. Still, I'm feeling ashamed, humiliated, and captive all at the same time. Escape from Alcatraz pops into my brain. I watched that movie at least a dozen times. And next thing I know, I'm fantasizing about being Clint Eastwood and figuring out some sort of plan to break out of this place. Scene 69. At the same time at CID headquarters at the media courthouse. Seated around the conference table are the chief of CID, the county DA, his chief prosecutor, Detectives Bishop and Gerber, and Dr. Nakamura. A little while ago, the chief begins, we arrested the Uber driver. He's charged with possession, intent to distribute, and sales, and he'll be arraigned in district court this afternoon. But, the DA says, as we all know by now, Ken performed the autopsy this morning. He found evidence of manual strangulation, and he changed the cause of death to homicide. We now believe, the chief interjects, that this Uber driver used the drugs to disguise the fact that he strangled her. But, the DA says, the change to homicide is problematic. We don't have enough evidence to arrest him for the homicide. That's why we arrested him on the drug charges. So, if any one of you are called as a witness at his arraignment or at his preliminary hearing, it's extremely critical that you did not mention anything about the autopsy or the change to homicide. What if his attorney brings it up? Dr. Nakamura asks. To begin with, the prosecutor says, his attorney won't know about the autopsy. But if it somehow comes up, I'll object and get it swept under the rug. Just don't any of you bring it up. So you want me to perjure myself? Just pretend the cause of death remains accidental overdose. Nobody outside this room knows about the autopsy. Not quite. Who else knows? My assistant was present. Nothing to worry about there. Nobody's going to call him as a witness. And that's the end of chapter 18. Join us next time when Steve gets processed into the criminal justice system and then stands trial at his preliminary hearing. Thanks for joining us. See you next time.